Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
Welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
This is Tom Hartman.
Your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity.
Now, here's Tom Hartman.
Sane and in Denmark. Yeah, greetings, my friends. Tom Hartman here, broadcasting live from Copenhagen, Denmark. This is the bookend of our trip in March, where we did we were for a week on the border of Darfur in southern Sudan in a refugee camp from one of the most god-awful, horrific, terrible, unbelievably painful places on earth to a place where, well, we'll have the author of the study on tomorrow, who says these are the happiest people in Europe. So here we are, broadcasting live from Copenhagen, Denmark, and with me Sophie Hastorp Anderson, did I pronounce that right?
That's right.
Okay, and Sophie is a member of Parliament. You're a legislator here, and also you're very pregnant. And I bring that up not gratuitously, but our Supreme Court in the United States is about to decide an issue about whether or not a company can fire a woman because she's become pregnant, or whether a state can pass a law that says that she must be able to have maternity leave without pay. But what's the situation here in Denmark?
Well, the situation in Denmark is that when you have a child, you go on maternity leave and you can get 6 months unpaid, and then you can take 6 months not paid from the company, but partly paid from the government.
So it's like a year of maternity leave that you're compensated for.
Yeah, and the husband, for some people.
And then the husband gets
You can share some of your maternity leave with your husband.
Uh-huh. Interesting. But as a member of Parliament, it's a little more difficult for you because you want to stick around and vote and be active. No,
when I go on maternity leave here in August, then I will refrain from voting.
Uh-huh.
We will call in for a substitute.
Ah, so you can appoint somebody to take your place, and then they leave when you come back at the end of your maternity leave.
Yes, when I was elected in my constitutional area, uh-huh. we were four people from the Social Democratic Party, which I represent,
right.
that was elected, and of course we had more candidates than that, mm-hmm. and so the man who was elected as number five but didn't get into parliament,
right.
he's my substitute or any other of the four other, he's substitute if any of us has to leave, for instance, to go on maternity leave or if you have to go to the UN, what's it called, the annual
yeah.
opening of the UN.
Right, or something like that. Then there's somebody who could stand in. That's fascinating. Actually, I was going to say Sophie, but you have a title, I'm assuming, as a member of Parliament. What is the title?
Well, I'm the spokeswoman on housing issues, but...
Mm-hmm. But in the United States, it would be like congressman or senator.
Yeah, here I would just be MP, member of Parliament.
So, okay. MP Anderson? Is it? Hastorp.
Yeah, we are very informal in Denmark.
Yeah.
So usually what we do is when we debate in the parliament, we call people by Mrs. or
mm-hmm. okay.
or Mister.
Yeah.
But outside or when we meet with the ministers, other places, we just call them by their names.
So I can call you Sophie.
Yeah.
You can call me Tom. Okay, Sophie. The one of the things I find fascinating, and in fact, why we wanted to have you on the program, and Leah suggested this, there's when you were starting your political career or starting your political activism and being involved with the party, your office was in a part of town where there was a bit of a problem.
Yeah.
You want to tell us about that?
Well, the offices were right next to the central station in mm-hmm. Copenhagen. And there was a lot of drug addicts, still are,
right.
in this area.
Right.
And I was around 20 years old, and we were debating welfare, the Scandinavian model, the European Union, all sorts of very hypothetical things. And just outside our windows, we could see drug addicts being held up by the police. Sometimes they had these raids on them, and kind of made me feel that maybe you should look outside your windows and see what happened and how people really felt out on the street.
In the United States, we have more people in prison, both in absolute numbers and per capita, than any country in the world, than even the worst dictatorships in the world. We have more people in prison per capita. And at least 20% of it is directly because people got arrested for drugs. And depending on whose numbers you're looking at, another 20 to 30% is indirectly because of drugs. So maybe as many as half of all the people in our prisons are there because of drugs. You have been very active in putting forward legislation in Denmark, which was just passed, if I understand this correctly, with one dissenting vote?
Yeah.
One dissenting vote. So this was virtually unanimous. That would do what?
That would give some drug addicts, long-term users, the possibility of getting heroin treatment for their addiction.
So this is free heroin for heroin addicts?
Yeah, for some of them, not all of them.
Right. So so it's not for somebody who, you know, last week decided, hey, let's try this out and let's get high. But for the people who are really in the grip of addiction and it is a medical crisis for them, Denmark has now decided to treat what they had treated as a criminal problem and what the United States treats as a criminal problem as a medical problem. Is that a good?
Yeah, you could say that. For a long time, we had this legislation in Denmark that if you were taken with a small amount of drugs and you could prove that it was only for yourself, then you would actually only get a warning and not be dragged into jail or anything like that.
Right, you could have like a gram of hashish or an ounce of marijuana.
Yeah, for instance.
Like that.
After a couple of years where we stopped on this sort of policy, we had just reinforced it again.
Yeah.
And that means that if you are a long-term user, you can show that you are addicted to for instance, marijuana or heroin or something like that. You can actually, you don't have to go to jail, you know, because you have these small amounts on you.
Right. So, yeah, my understanding was that for a long time, the government's policy was basically with small amounts in personal use of a whole spectrum of drugs, actually, that it was just, you know, it's a warning, like you said.
Yeah.
And then when the new prime minister came in, who by American conservatives would be called conservative, I guess here you'd call it right wing or a little to the right, they changed that. Denmark changed that and criminalized even personal possession. Did you just decriminalize personal possession in addition to offering free heroin to heroin addicts?
It's not decriminalized totally, but they have sort of softened it up because they could see that it didn't work on the streets.
Right.
The police used all their time on small dealers or small people who are just being addicted to drugs instead of going after the very big fish, going after the big men who are actually selling, you know, tons of drugs, getting them into Denmark. So,
I'm assuming that when you put this legislation together, that you looked at the experience of other countries. I mean, certainly we in the United States, we saw alcohol prohibition back in the 1930s and what a failure that was. And I would say that many Americans realize that marijuana prohibition is an absolute failure, but it's still a largely taboo subject in our country. Didn't the UK do this some time back, or were there other countries whose experience, the Netherlands that you were looking at?
Yes, the Netherlands started out on a heroin treatment, offering it to the long-term users. I think it was in 2002, and Switzerland also had trials and is now giving it as a permanent treatment offer. And Germany is having trials at the moment. The UK are also having scientific trials.
Right. Right, interesting. And what these countries are finding is what?
Well, what they're finding is that the drug users take up this treatment very well.
Yeah.
They they actually, for some of them, get drug free, get clean someday. It's actually more effective than methadone treatment.
Yeah, I understand methadone is actually more addictive than heroin. I've read in medical.
What I heard is that methadone is very difficult to get out of again. It's more just as addictive as heroin, but it's even worse to get detoxed.
To withdraw
from.
Yeah, that heroin withdrawal is a matter of weeks, and methadone withdrawal can take months.
I think that if you know some who has been drug users for many years, they can tell you that a lot of times they had tried themselves to become clean on heroin,
right.
But it's virtually impossible when they use methadone.
Interesting. We're talking with Sophie Hestorp, Anderson, a member of parliament here in Denmark, and she'll be taking your calls as well. If you'd like to call, if you have a question about this or any other aspect of Danish life, our number 1-866-303-2270, toll free nationwide. It's the Tom Hartmann radio program right here on Air America. Stick around.
Tom Hartmann.
Taking back the mainstream media.
3 hours a day, 5 days a week.
This is the Tom Hartmann program.
We can do away with George W. Bush real quick with break free from Republican politics. Welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you, broadcasting live from Copenhagen, Denmark. And Sophie Hestorp Anderson is with me. She is a member of parliament. And Sophie, two questions before we pick up some calls from our listeners. I really appreciate your being willing to be with us for this hour and talk with people about a wide variety of aspects of Danish life. First of all, with regard to the free heroin for heroin addicts and treating heroin as a medical problem that Denmark has now passed into law, and with one dissenting vote. And he was the one guy who got up and gave a speech against it, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Anyway, how does law enforcement view this? What kind of feedback did you get from police departments?
Well, usually the police departments don't get very much involved into politics, but when they do, they actually say that they can see that drug users have a lot of social problems, and they're kind of tired of being the ones who has to deal with social problems on the streets, right, instead of actually having a place to send these people to.
Yeah.
For instance, what you could call a place, you know, where people could stay and take their drugs. Some call them injection rooms, for instance.
Right.
We don't have that in Denmark yet, but we're also debating this. Or sending them to a treatment that really works. What happened here the last year was that one of the Danish newspapers actually brought up a story about a girl named Linda who was 20 years old, and she had been a heroin addict since she was 16 years old. Mm-hmm. Came from a very distorted family, of course. And she could tell the story about how she was actually engaging in having sex with a 71-year-old man who was giving her sort of drugs so she could appear dead while he had sex with her.
Oh my.
And this story came, you know, in front of the newspaper. It became a huge debate in Denmark, how people who are addicted to drugs.
She was basically prostituting herself for the drugs.
And prostitution is not illegal in Denmark, but it's illegal to make money off prostitutes.
So it's illegal to exploit. The exploitation is illegal.
Yeah.
But that's interesting. So law enforcement seems relieved.
Yeah.
Like this, you know, this isn't our problem anymore. Now the health service will take care of it. And
they will still have a lot of problems because a lot of people who take drugs are not motivated for getting into treatment.
Sure.
I think normally we say that drug users, you know, live on, party on, take drugs for all sorts of reasons for 5 years or more before they get get to the point where it's just too difficult. You cannot find any veins anymore. You cannot find any places where to get the drugs. You don't have any money. It's all about crime and everything like that. And
ultimately, people typically, though, reach a point where they're just, they're not interested in being a drug addict any longer.
Yeah.
That's fascinating. I wanted to talk about children. Louise and I have three kids, and when and we didn't go through the math on this, but in the United States they say basically plan on a child costing $250,000, and the reason why is because, and that's the average in the United States. The reason why is because you've got the cost of birth, the deductibles that the medical, the health insurance doesn't pay. I mean, it can cost anywhere from a few thousand to $20,000-$30,000 to have a baby, just the medical part of it, and then education. There's all kinds of costs associated with education. If you want your child to go to college, it can cost up to, $20,000 to $100,000 a year, depending on the school. And then there, some people choose to have private schools and things. And so, it's an expensive proposition to have a child between the cost of education and the cost of medical care and all those years that you have to pay for their health insurance. And so, how much does it cost to have a child here in Denmark?
I don't know, because we have a tax-financed healthcare system, so I don't have to pay to be pregnant or to give birth or anything like that. And when my baby is around 6 months to 12 months, I would getting an offer for a kindergarten, and it cost me around, I can't remember how many much money. It's quite expensive, but the offer is very good because it makes you so you can go back to work. It's a full time, full day arrangement.
Very high quality daycare.
Very high, with educated people taking care of your child.
Uh-huh. And is that partly paid for by the state as well?
Yes,
is it subsidized.
Partly subsidized. Mm-hmm. Every 3 months, you get a check from the government. In order for you to take care of the extra expenses of by having a baby.
Amazing.
It doesn't cover fully what you spend on the kindergarten, but it's nice.
Yeah,
and it's for everybody. It doesn't even matter how rich you are or how poor you are.
Right.
And if you are poor, you get the kindergarten for free almost.
Yeah, instead of having to pay for it.
Yeah, because we think it's more important that you can actually make a contact with a job.
Yeah, fascinating. Sophie Hestorp Andersen is with us. She is a member of parliament here in Denmark, and we'll be taking your calls for Sophie at 866-303-2270 right after this break. It's the Tom Hartmann program live from Copenhagen here on Air America Radio. TomHartmann.com, AirAmerica.com, 866-303-2270.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
To see our guest, you can go to SOPH, as in Sophie, but just SOPH.DK, as in Denmark. SOPH.DK, and that is Sophie Hestorp Andersen's website as a member of parliament, and at the very bottom is her video that she used to promote her candidacy. And so let's pick up some callers here, 866-303-2270, a whole wide variety of topics. Jeff in Tacoma, Washington, you're on the air with me and with Member of Parliament Andersen.
Hey, Tom, great show, and nice to hear from Sophie. As a Danish-American myself, I would just like to say how proud I am to hail from such a progressive and democratic country, and I wish you guys had the right of return.
So you're not a Danish citizen. You're a Danish ancestry American.
That's right. Yeah, my grandfather was from Denmark. But I would like to ask, I'm a trade unionist. I've been very outspoken about drug legalization and other controversial topics. And in the way I see it, the only way I could ever get elected to public office is if we had full public financing of elections. And I wonder if Denmark has ever had anything like that or if it's in the works.
Okay. Jeff, thanks for the call. Sophie, how does it work here? You've run for political office. Do you run ads on TV? Do you raise money? How does it work?
You have to raise money, and as a social democratic, it is usually money from the trade unions or other ones who want to support you.
Right.
But because it's illegal to advertise on TV.
It's illegal to advertise on television?
Yeah, even for the party as a whole.
For any politician?
Yeah.
Nobody, even a friend of yours can't run an ad saying vote for Sophie?
No.
No.
So that makes the cost kind of low that you need, because the cost you need is to make sure you could put up billboards in your constitutional area. Okay. You have to make sure that you can make a nice homepage or that you could get out there with some flyers and everything like that. But other than that, you have to, you know, maybe you can buy yourself a commercial on radio.
Right.
It's okay.
Is it mostly, though, retail politics, going door to door, knocking on doors and saying, hi, I'm running for office and here's my flyer?
Yeah. Standing in the street.
Out literature, getting lawn signs.
Yeah, and then we have a lot of television stations who want to promote there is going to be an election, and they have a lot of debates on TV with all sorts of different candidates. You know, we have 8 political parties at the moment. I think we have 7 or 8 political parties in the parliament at the moment.
Right.
So you get offers to get out on schools and where the people, you know, the elderly are and everything like that, and try to come into live debates with the people there.
So it's just a matter of getting out there and getting, but none of this costs any money. This is because the radio and television stations are encouraged to do this, or, well, actually you have Danish radio, Danish television.
It doesn't cost anything to go on, it doesn't cost anything to go on television and be a part of a debate.
Right.
What can really take out money is when you want to make ads in the newspapers, of course. That's a real killer.
that's the one.
But all the parties are getting some money from the state.
So there is public financing, isn't
there? Some. We get some money when my party get like almost a million voters or something like that. You get a small amount for each voter that you could save up to election, or you can have between elections.
Fascinating. Let's see here. Victor in Miami, Florida. You're on the air with a member of Parliament, Anderson.
Hey, Victor? How you guys doing?
Good.
Great. Congratulations, Sophie, on the baby. That's number one.
Thank you.
Okay. Hey, I tell you what, listening to the show, Tom, it gives me great optimism and depressing. It's depressing at the same time. It's optimistic knowing that people can create a government like Denmark that can handle such complex issues in a humane way and make it effective. It's depressing because I don't live in that situation in my own country. and as a parent, Tom, I heard you mention being a parent. I too am a parent, a proud parent. 6 daughters, 3 sons.
Wow.
One of them are named Sophia, too, Sophie. But I tell you what, I pray that we can find a way to model a lot of our ideology the way I hear it being expressed in Denmark, and hopefully that we can see that my children will see that one day. So it was more or less an open comment and just to say how much I appreciate the show and the optimism.
Thank you.
You guys have a great day.
Thank you very much. I guess there wasn't a question there, so we'll go to a question. Victor, nice comments. Dave in North Hollywood, California, listening on K-Talk. Hey, Dave.
Hello. What a great show.
Thank you.
I've known a couple of Danes over the years, and they always ask me why fundamentalists have so much influence over government here. And when I've asked them why fundamentalists don't have as much influence in Denmark. Of course, the Danes I've known haven't been sociologists or experts in that. And so I was wondering if Member of Parliament, I forgot your last name.
Hester Benderson.
If she could, I don't know, address that and just explain how it, because for instance, the drug thing, a lot of the opposition to decriminalization or legalization comes from crazy religious right-wingers, and you don't seem to have that problem. And the last thing is, if Obama doesn't win, can I come live in Denmark?
Okay, Dave, thank you very much. So, Sophie, two quick questions. Is there a fundamentalist, politically active, presumably Christian fundamentalist group in Denmark and that attempts to influence legislation?
Well, there is, but they have always been very, very small. And the last two elections, they didn't get into parliament.
Oh, interesting.
And here, the last 2 years, they have gone into a very big mold, or you could say. So right now, for instance, on the question on abortion, for instance, where they have always raised their, held up their heads and talked against abortion and against pro-life. Right now, they have a new chairman who has just given up that point of view.
Interesting. So abortion is legal here, but my understanding is that the number of abortions that are practiced in Scandinavian countries is actually much lower than in the United States because you have wide access to birth control and good public education about sex education.
Yeah.
Is that accurate?
Yeah, I think that's quite accurate. We try to have programs that keep the abortion rates low. We had a little increase in the rate of abortions, but it's been mostly with people immigrants and.
Yeah.
Actually, people maybe from religious beliefs.
From religious societies,
yeah.
Fundamentalist religious societies. Interesting. Oh, and the second part, Dave wants to know if he can come live in Denmark. It's kind of tough to get in here.
It is kind of tough to get into Denmark, but if you can get a well-paid job, if for instance with working information technology or computers or anything like that we are really lacking.
You can get a working visa.
Yeah.
There you go. Sally in Oakland, California, you're on the air with Sophie.
Oh, hi, Sophie and Tom. Tom, I'm Sam Rubin's mom. We met you at the 11th hour.
Oh, great.
We're out here.
Hi, Sally.
Sophie, I'm a homeschooling mom, and I'm a co-author of a book that I've written for and about women called The Overfunctioning Woman's Handbook. Sorry, I ripped this off from you, Tom. Uncommon Sense to Deal with Impossible Jobs and Impossible People.
That's great.
And my my question is, how do women in your country view American women, and what advice would you give us? Because we're really challenged here with family and work issues.
Interesting. Interesting question. Thank you, Sally.
Well, my view on American women is that they are very independent, mostly, and they're actually are working towards becoming even more independent, getting a job of their own, anything like that. But I see a lot of barriers. I mean, I wouldn't like to live in New York, not having somebody to take care of my child, or it would be very expensive for me. Mm. That is quite a barrier. And
so the lack of publicly funded health care or pre-education.
Yeah, exactly. Kindergartens or daycare, nursery homes or something like that for the children is making it very difficult to keep a job, 35 or 40 hours a week where you can make up your own money. So if I was an American woman, I would certainly work to get some of the politicians to make more efforts to getting a better welfare for the children.
For 20 years, we've been trying just to get a simple amendment to the Constitution passed that says that it's illegal to discriminate based on gender.
Mm.
And the Republicans every single year block this thing. I mean, it's just that simple. This is a much more egalitarian society, I believe.
Well, in Denmark, we think that we are very high on equality issues, but actually most of our equality lawmaking is actually from the European Union.
Well, interesting. So this is something that's really all over Europe. This is just not unique to Denmark.
Some of the things are, for instance, that you cannot discriminate women on in the workforce.
Right, marvelous. Member of Parliament, Sophie Hastorp Anderson is with us. We'll be back with your calls 45 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program.
You are listening to Tom Hartman.
Nine and a half minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Sophie Hastorp Anderson is with us. She is a member of parliament in the Danish legislature. And her website, by the way, soph.dk, as in soph.denmark.dk. So if you want to check it out, 866-303-2270. Devron in Seattle. Hey, Devron, you're on the air with Sophie.
Hello, Mr. Hartman and Mrs. Anderson. I just want to say that, you know, I sit here and I listen, and I hear a lot of positive things going on over there. And I know you guys speak, like, more than one language, because you speak English very well. All of your guests have. And I say that because here in America, it's, you know, unless you're a foreigner or you've really studied hard in school, you mainly just speak English. But is there anything in American society that you guys like or would like to emulate? There's so many things about your society that we, you know, of course we'd like to have, but I just...
Interesting question, Devron. By the way, I had a taxi driver yesterday who spoke so little English that I couldn't I couldn't communicate to him the name of my hotel. But point is well taken. Sophie, are there parts of America that the Danes look at and say, hey, why can't we be like that?
Yeah, of course.
For example.
And... let me add that, of course, we are looking into the positive things right now and not mm-hmm. debating all the negatives.
Yeah. In other words, Danish society has problems, too. It's
yeah,
not,
of
this
course.
Is not a paradise.
Of course, yeah. We do. What I find fascinated about the U.S., and for instance, now that we have the debate on drug users, mm-hmm. is that, for instance, in San Francisco, you have people like Marcia Rosenbaum. She's been working a lot of years on a program called Safety First, mm-hmm. and it's about going out to young people, and instead of just saying, just say no, just say no, just say no,
right.
you know, have this very prohibitive way of looking into to how to deal with drugs,
right.
she's actually engaging in telling young people what's the dangers of doing drugs, and what should you be aware of if your friends or other ones are...
So this is drug education like
yeah.
sex education.
Exactly.
Let's talk about it candidly.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I look... she has a wonderful website and some programs that... that they've been working on for quite some years now that I would like to make a part of the Danish educational system if I could.
Oh, great. Great. Fascinating. Let's see here. Gary in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. You're on the air with Mrs. Anderson, Member of Parliament Anderson.
Oh, hey.
Hello.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, it's just a pleasure to talk to you. Good day to you and Mrs. Anderson there. Something you were talking about before... hello?
Yeah, we're on here.
Yeah, something you were talking about before about how it seems like when the conservative elements come into power, they tend to enhance this so-called war on drugs to the point where they go out there like the small fries and the users and the little people. I don't believe it's a coincidence. I believe that it's actually intended to do that, it's a twofold thing. They enhance the criminal justice system, which is a huge cash cow in this country as well as other places. And they do it to intentionally kind of take the eye off the big fish. And that's done, I think, intentionally because if they do investigate these big fish, sooner or later, they're going to come into contact with groups like the Cocaine Importers of America, otherwise known as the CIA, and their and all of the
so Gary, you're basically the question is sort of the John Dillinger question, I guess, Sophie. At what point do you think that it's possible that countries are actually having a war on drugs because they like the fact that we have that it causes there to be big drug cartels and profits? It's kind of a stretch. But why would somebody be opposed to it? You had one member of parliament who stood up in opposition to free heroin for heroin addicts here. Mm. Why?
Well, he was very much under influence from the people, from the fathers and mothers of sons and daughters who are drug users and who think that if you are a drug user or a drug addict, then you should just go into like a treatment where there's no substances at all.
I see.
Like, for instance, the Minnesota model or... what you could call even Scientology prey.
Right. Yeah, that's right.
But give
you saunas is what they.
But I don't. I mean, I think it's true that we have this international war on drugs, and we talk a lot about saying no to drugs, and yeah, we talk about it like it's a war, and we also treat it as a war sometimes in the streets, you know, with raids and everything like that.
Right.
What we need is also to talk about the war casualties, the people who live in the street are actually being a victim of this war on drugs.
Right.
And maybe look at it from their perspective.
Yeah.
Because it's not always so easy. And then if you look at their perspective and if you go into, let's see, what would you do if it was really a war? Then you would have the International Red Cross, for instance, going into the street and making sure people getting health care.
There you go.
Acute healthcare.
Right.
And maybe that's what we need sometimes, to actually go into the streets and making sure that these people are also taken care of and taken into hospital if that's what they need, or taken care of their health and their diseases.
It seems like that's what you've done here. We have about 40 seconds before we have to wrap up this hour. Jeremy in Vancouver, a quick question?
Yes, good morning. I had a quick question, two quick questions here. The first one being, what is the general consensus of your population concerning offering a program like this, whether it be giving these addicts drugs on the side or putting them through a treatment program without it? And two, what are the costs of this program?
Okay. Broad popular support, what does it cost?
Well, actually, I think the government has actually put this law proposal and it got through government because we could see in the polls that more and more people were actually in favor of it.
Yeah.
I think in the last polls it was 70%.
Wow.
And what does it cost? What does it cost not to do it? I mean, it's
absolutely.
I mean, some of these people have tried to get into treatment 20 times and still haven't benefited from it.
Sophie, we have to wrap it up. Thanks so much for being here. SOPH.DK, Sophie Haystorp Anderson, thank you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
The Tom Hartman Program, where smart people get their news.
Listening to Tom Hartman.
The Tom Hartman Program.
Exposing the con in conservative.
This is Tom Hartman.
I guess you could figure out our politics. Welcome back. Henrik Binslev is with us. By the way, at the top of the next hour, Scott McClellan is going to drop by. It should be an interesting conversation. But right now, Henrik Binslev is with us. He is the director of RESO at DTU. This is the research organization with the Danish Technical University that is doing work on wind power. Is that a reasonable?
Well, we
Henrik?
Do research over a broad range of topics. The common denominator is renewable energies and also nuclear technologies for medical purposes, principally.
Oh, interesting, interesting. I noticed that. In fact, I was just looking at some of the statistics here on wind power in Denmark, and in 2001, you were generating 12% of your electricity with wind power. That was over 2 million megawatts, or 2,000 megawatts,
two gigawatts,
2 billion watts. Then in 2002, it went to 13%, 2003, 15%, 2004, 18%. By 2007, it was at 19%. What percentage of your electricity?
20% now.
20% this year.
Yeah.
And flying in here, as we flew in over the harbor here in Copenhagen, we saw the giant windmills. They've become the skyline, you know, the new skyline.
Did you notice they were standing on a curve?
No, I didn't. Explain this to me.
Well, it's part of the challenge is that windmills, of course, are a part of your visual impression of your surroundings.
Uh-huh.
And therefore, when they're close to a city, then we also think about what is the aesthetics of it. And therefore, the architect thought it was quite nice that they would have a curve. So when you're seeing them from, when you're landing, when you're flying into Copenhagen, then you will see them lining up on a nice curve. And you see one hiding behind the other, and then they're coming out.
That's right.
At the back.
And in fact, looking, I can see them from my hotel room.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them look smaller than the others, and I know that it's just perspective. It's like they're farther away. And they're just cranking all the time. There's one that seems to be down for maintenance. There was a barge next to it when we came in. But
unfortunate thing.
Yeah. But I, Leah was mentioning that her parents are members of a cooperative that apparently people all over Denmark own the part of their power, or they're, you have these public power co-ops that people buy into and they build windmills?
That used to be the case. Now it's moving more towards big business, that offshore wind farms is really, as any other big power generating facility, is really big capital.
Right.
There is, though, the situation on land that, because indeed when you're close to where people are living, then there's certain irritation at seeing these beautiful windmills. There's a certain irritation that you can hear the wind noise. So therefore, if people own a share in it, then just like farmers can better accommodate the wonderful noises of a farm, then windmill owners can better accommodate the beautiful aesthetics and the sounds of a windmill. So I think in recent years, there's been an active policy of trying to get the co-ownership in the community. That's different from what it was in the earlier days, where indeed it was collaborative, co-ops. But that's not the case really anymore.
And Denmark is one of the major exporters now to the world.
That's correct.
About wind turbines.
About 40% of windmills in the world are built in Denmark.
Wow. So you've turned. And this is Bernie Sanders is a U.S. senator who comes on our show every Friday and takes calls from our listeners. And he just has been banging on this thing for the six years that he's been a guest on our show, you know, almost every week. If we just had alternative energy technology, we could create jobs and we could be export. And
you're right. And he is right.
Yeah.
Because this is a business area that's expanding massively. Mm. Last year, it was worth $100 billion, and that was
just in Denmark.
No, worldwide.
Oh, worldwide, okay.
Denmark is not bad.
You're talking the wind.
Dimension. No. That's all sustainable energy technologies.
Okay.
Renewable energy technologies. That market was worth $100 billion last year. But the interesting thing is that it was a doubling in just over 2 years.
Wow.
And that rate of increase appears to be carrying on. And in fact, just actually this morning, we had a presentation in the Danish Industry Association of the new International Energy Agency's report on what's the outlook for energy technologies and how we're going to meet the challenges of climate change, how we're going to move away from carbon-based energy sources. And what does that involve? Well, he gave an astronomical figure for just what the investments worldwide are going to be in energy technologies until 2050. That is, of course, a few years still. But that was $45 trillion of extra spending.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you could say that means, in a sense, a burden on all of us, because, of course, dealing with a challenge often means extra effort. But it's also a business opportunity.
Yeah.
And even if you divide the number of days from now until 2050, if you divide that into $45 trillion U.S. dollars, it still represents an enormous business opportunity.
Yeah.
And I think that's what Denmark is benefiting from now and what U.S. should be benefiting from. That
right.
U.S. is a very innovative society, very good at seeing opportunities, getting good minds to work at finding solutions. And, of course, here you can marry two things, that you're going, on the one hand, after doing what's good for the planet, and on the other hand, earning money.
Sure.
And exactly what we're wanting to do here in Denmark. We wouldn't mind doing it together with some of our American friends.
Yeah, it's called doing well by doing good.
Exactly.
It seems like a reasonable thing. The problem is that in America, we've got a lot of politicians who are in the back pockets of, frankly, ExxonMobil and Chevron and the big oil companies. And they're getting all these campaign contributions, and there's this enormous amount of lobbying, and there's a huge campaign to convince Americans that there is no such thing as global warming, and even if there is, it's got nothing to do with oil, that the sun is getting hotter or something. And it's basically the fossil fuel industry, coal, oil, and gas, just hanging on to squeeze every last profit that they can out of the American consumer. And do you have those debates here?
We do, but look at British Petroleum, which is not called British Petroleum anymore. BP, they are now an energy company. They're no longer just a petroleum company.
Right.
They have seen where is the business in the future. So they are already now sowing the seeds of what's going to be their livelihood in the future.
Right.
And so they're putting themselves behind it. Now, I think it would actually be a very good business proposition also in the U.S. simply to say, well, what are we going to be living off in 20, 30 years' time? Well,
right.
let's take the initiative now and sow those seeds.
Right.
And even if there was a significant effort on all parts to move into renewable energy technologies, rest assured that there's still going to be a market for oil and gas and coal.
There'll still be profit to be made in the carbon-based industry.
Of course, because it will take a lot of time to move out of it. But it's going to be a big and exciting effort to move into the new technologies.
Yeah. But ExxonMobil in the last quarter showed a larger quarterly profit than any corporation in the history of the world going back to the Roman Empire.
Wow.
And the former CEO of ExxonMobil walked away with a $400 million goodbye package as his compensation. I mean, and they're spreading tens of millions. I mean, $15 million a day on average is spent lobbying our senators and members of Congress. I mean, it's just mind-boggling. And much of that is coming from the fossil fuel industry, and they're just tenaciously hanging onto this thing. And they're getting huge subsidies. Did it take government subsidies to birth this industry here in Denmark, or did Danish entrepreneurs do this?
It was actually a wonderful triple helix, as we call it, a mixture of political will to invest at a time where it was not competitive, plus a lot of individual entrepreneurs who were just keen to try this out. Mm-hmm. And then the third leg, not to forget, and that was research. There happened to be a competence base that could stand in as soon as the ideas to try to develop this, they could actually make these windmills, give them a sound scientific and engineering foundation. And you know where that competence came from? That was Danish program in developing nuclear energy that provided the materials technology and the knowledge of how the wind blows. That was the basis for starting up our wind adventure.
So one thing led to another.
It's, exactly.
Good science leads to good science. And
yes.
Research leads to research.
Leads to new opportunities by solving the essential problems in getting a technology to work.
That's great. We're talking with Hendrik Bindslev. He's the director of RISO of the DTU, the National Laboratory for Sustainable Energy at the Technical University of Denmark. And I'd like to ask you about what the Germans are doing with solar power and how, you know, what you're looking at there, what the future models of this, the costs are, and also will you take some calls from our listeners if they have
questions?
Sure. Great. 866-303-2270, our telephone number, 16 minutes past the hour.
This is Tom Hartmann.
The Tom Hartmann Program.
Truth in Broadcasting.
I'm telling you.
About as good ever
free college, free health care.
If there's anything,
free child care. A year's maternity leave. It doesn't get much better than this.
Good for recruitment.
I guess
for international recruitment.
There you go. We're talking with Henrik Binslev. He is the director of RISO, DTU, which is the Research Institute of the National Laboratory for Sustainable Energy. And a couple of questions. What do you do when the wind doesn't blow? You're 20% of your power is now coming from the wind.
That's right, and we want to go even further than that. We might go up to 50%. And indeed, what do we do when the wind doesn't blow? Well, in the short term, we just need backup capacity. And, of course, economically, that's not optimal. So what we're working on is a combination of storage capabilities so that you can keep the electricity in huge batteries, but not really just batteries. We're talking about different storage facilities. One is hydro dams, so hydropower.
You pump
water backwards up into the dam. That's actually functioning today. So when the wind blows in Denmark, then the hydropower plants in Norway run backwards. They pump the water up, and when it doesn't blow, they let the water out, and they give us our electricity back.
Amazing.
Yeah, that's a bad deal, though, because we sell it cheap and buy it expensive.
Oh, yeah.
So we want to do something else. And in any case, storage is going to become one of the really valued commodities in our energy systems.
Right.
So another route that's interesting and being pursued in Denmark is electrical cars, because there we would actually be doing two good things in one. On the one hand, replacing petrol and diesel in the cars, that would reduce the emissions in the transport sector, which is just going up and up and up.
Right.
And at the same time, that would pay for a huge storage facility. If
the cars themselves become the storage facility.
The batteries in the cars become the storage facility. A car only drives a small fraction of its time. So it sits in the parking lot at work or in the garage at home and doesn't do any good, except in this new mode. There would be doing a lot of good business actually also for its owner, because it would be buying electricity cheap when there's too much, and it would be selling it more expensive when there's too much, and that means the private consumer would be earning money leaving his car in the parking lot or in the garage. And at the same time, the general power supply would benefit, because we would have electricity when the wind wasn't blowing. Then we would simply have the millions of cars charging away, giving their electricity off from
right.
their batteries.
So for example, if my car is plugged in overnight when there's very little demand for electricity,
yes.
I'm buying electricity at, let's just pull numbers out of the air, I'm paying a penny a watt, for example,
that would be
or
cheap.
Kilowatt.
Yeah.
Yeah. Penny, let's say I'm paying a penny.
Yeah.
But during the day, peak demand, I could sell it for 3 pennies.
That's right. Yeah.
And so out of my own car.
Yes.
So I drive my car to work and I plug it into a place at work and I start selling back to the utility the electricity that I bought from the utility
yeah.
overnight.
Exactly.
And my car becomes part of a multi-million car giant storage battery for the country.
Exactly.
And as a side effect, I get to drive it.
Yes, and not only that. It turns out we've been at RISO, we have not just scientists working on the physical science. We also have economists, and they have worked out what's the value of that service, i.e. buying when it's expensive, when it's cheap and selling when it's expensive, or providing that storage facility. And that service is worth much more than your average energy consumption for transport. In other words,
you're going to pay me to drive my car?
That's right. Well, it'll pay you to have the battery. And
right.
so the utility will pay you to have the would like you to have the battery.
Right.
And therefore, they will give you the electricity either virtually free or maybe even free, and just say, well, it costs a lot to have the battery, to produce the battery is expensive.
Right.
But the utility will say, okay, I'll lease the battery to you.
Right.
Because it did cost the utility a lot to build the battery.
Right.
But as long as you plug it into the net most of the time, then we don't mind that you use some of our electricity, because the utility will say it's much more worth much more to us that we can use the storage. That's one way of thinking of it. The other way is that you have another mode of operating. This could be simply that it's total free market, and each car is equipped with a computer where the driver has a strategy. He says, okay, I need to drive to work in this from 8 o'clock to 9 o'clock, and I need to go back at, say, 6 o'clock to 7 o'clock. So, in other words, my battery should be high there.
Right.
And in the meantime, find the best buying and selling strategy. You know, you work on, it's on the stock market, and you don't have people doing the stock markets really. It's computers. Right. And therefore, of course, it has to work out what is the typical rhythm and find the right way, right strategy. And even with that, you would make money. Okay. And now you'd say, what happens if I do something out of the ordinary? Yes, indeed. If you want to suddenly go and visit your aunt, or you want to go on holiday and it doesn't fit with the strategy, then you do need a little extra petrol tank and, for instance, a fuel cell. And then you will go in and tank as normal, get the fuel cell to charge your battery, and then you keep on driving. And that, of course, will be more expensive in terms of consuming fuel than just tanking pure electricity. Right. So normally you would only tank your electricity, but for the off event, then you would have the freedom. And that's one of the...
But you still don't have an internal combustion engine.
Well, you could combine it with an internal combustion engine. So in the short term, it would probably be an internal combustion engine optimized so that it could charge as you need.
And Denmark and Israel are working on these things. I want to hear about the taxation scheme when we come back from the break, about how it is that... I mean, this isn't airy-fairy, you know, eye in the or head in the sky stuff. You're actually putting this into place.
Yes.
I want the details. 27, and I want all of our American listeners to be yelling at their legislators. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
It came along. Everyone that knew him knew which side that he'd be on. He never was a hero for this county's shining light, but you could always find him standing up for what he thought was right. He'd say, "You've got to stand for something, or you'll fall for anything."
Yeah, standing for a better world. Tom Hartman here with you. Dr. Henrik Pinslev is with us. He is the director of, you pronounce it so beautifully,
PCU, the National Laboratory for Sustainable Energy.
RISU. Yeah, that's RISU. DTU, the National Laboratory for Sustainable Energy. And, you know, some of the conversations we've been having off the air, so I want to bring it all back on the air. This is absolutely fascinating stuff. You're moving ahead with this plan to use cars as storage systems and have cars. And it's happening in Denmark and it's happening in Israel. And how is this? And how can other countries do this?
In Denmark, it's interesting because of the very high tax rate on cars. And there's a tax break on electrical cars.
Ah.
And that, of course, means that it doesn't necessarily work out financially in other countries. In Denmark, it's being done because, on the one hand, we know that we have to stimulate technologies that are not cheap enough for the market, but where we make use of the fact that by doing, you learn. And the more systems you put in place, the cheaper it becomes, and eventually becomes cheap enough. And in addition, of course, we need the storage capacity, because we're the country in the world with the largest amount of wind power, and we're going to keep on building up more wind power. And by doing that, we learn how to deal with it and develop technologies for it, and that means by facing the challenges early, you develop your competence, and there with that, the business. And so in the long run, I think it will pay off, just now, like it did with the wind energy.
Now, in the United States, we have areas very, very long distances that some people will drive. And one of the suggestions that I've heard many times, and I'd love to get your take on this, is that a great way to store electricity is through hydrolysis. In other words, taking water, breaking it into hydrogen and oxygen, storing the hydrogen, compressing the hydrogen, putting pipelines, gas stations, liquefying it, whatever, and then having hydrogen fuel cell operated electric cars.
Mm-hmm.
Is that, you know, on the scale of the different ways that you would want to store electricity, where does that fall? And what are the things that you're working with?
Well, Converting it into hydrogen is certainly one of the big research areas. Now, hydrogen is a difficult substance to store because you have to put it under enormous pressure in order to get it into a container that can drive your car for a long distance. The alternative is to put it into metals. Funnily enough, hydrogen can dissolve into metals, and actually you can dissolve an awful lot of hydrogen, so there's actually more hydrogen in a given solid piece of metal than if you were to make that metal hollow and just put pressure inside.
Is this what's called hydrides?
Yes, exactly. But there's a major research effort, and there's also research in that in our institute.
Uh-huh.
But there's also alternative routes, and that is just like you can split up water into hydrogen and oxygen, you could also split up carbon dioxide into carbon monoxide and oxygen, and then carbon monoxide and hydrogen. That's something that's called synthesis gas. Mm-hmm. And there we can, with existing technologies, convert that into liquid fuels, for instance, methanol and things like that. And if we were to do that, then we can use more standard infrastructure that we know today. So you can have a normal...
So you can create methanol out of water using electricity, basically?
Yes, out of water and carbon dioxide. But you have carbon dioxide coming out of our power plant. So if we take that carbon dioxide and don't pump it into the underground, but just say... Okay,
into the air.
Preferably not into the air, but... So let's say we collect the carbon dioxide,
right,
and then instead of pumping it underground, we put it into an electrolysis facility. Mm-hmm. And there, either with electricity generated from wind, from solar, well, even from nuclear, then you could be converting that into liquid fuels. And that is another route that we're considering.
What's your timeline?
Well, the timeline for the hydrogen storages are quite long. So in the short term, we have to rely on pressurized hydrogen.
But no, I mean, for like your electric cars. And
the electric cars.
And you talked about hitting 50 to 80% of your
wind power. The electrical cars in Denmark, there, I think that the current business that is being developed is expected to have the first cars out in Denmark in around 2011 or 12. So that's not far in the future.
3 years.
Now that will then be, of course, initially small scale. And the hope is, my hope is certainly that with a better optimized incentive system, then on the time of maybe 15 years, as much as 20 or 30 or even 50% of the fleet in Denmark could be electrical cars. But I believe in the model where it's electrical cars where you can also tank a fuel.
Mm-hmm.
So that you can have a combination. So that's really like
a
hybrid.
So if you want to drive to Italy, you can do it.
Yes, exactly. You know, and it's really like a hybrid, except it's a super hybrid, where you have a really strong battery, and you can drive very fast purely on the battery.
Right.
Fast and far on the battery.
Fascinating. I want to take some calls here. Just a very quick question, though. You mentioned when we were on the break that these propellers on these giant wind turbines that I saw as we were flying in over Copenhagen are the size of a 747.
Well,
what are the limits? Where and what about, you know, small ones, neighborhoods, homes, things
right.
like that?
You're right. The size is actually bigger than the jumbo jet now. So each wing is now approaching 100 meters. So it wings has a total span of 200 meters.
Wow.
So that's bigger than your jumbo jet. And indeed, these wings, they are high-tech stuff because the materials are stretched to the absolute limits of what materials can take. Maximal strength combined with lightness, and they have to flex in the right way because these are actually very long, slender structures which are bouncing around in a turbulent wind, and they have to stand even the hurricane. That really means you're developing new materials just for windmills.
Mm-hmm.
And not only that, they also are equipped with tiny, well, really like small feathers on birds of prey that vibrate to counteract the turbulence in the wind so that they can stabilize themselves. And this is a fascinating feedback.
Smart blades.
Yes, with a feedback system where you're measuring what the wind is doing and so on. And you're mentioning whether we also want small windmills. Yes, small windmills are being developed, but no longer in Denmark, no longer in the major players. But it is actually being developed, for instance, in India, where there are now also major companies growing, and they will be supplying small windmills. But in, for instance, Big Vestas, the biggest company in the wind industry. There you couldn't order a small windmill anymore.
Yeah.
And you ask, what's the limit? Well, currently the windmills you buy are approximately 2 to 3 megawatts. And their plans for 5 megawatts. And there's even research effort going on until 10 megawatts. But it's not certain that that will be optimal. It could well be that the optimal windmill is around 3 to 5 megawatts, and that the effort goes into making it cheaper, making it faster to produce, and making it more reliable.
Right. So 5 megawatts, for comparison, a standard coal-fired power plant.
It's 100 times bigger.
About 100 times. So 100 windmills, and you've got one entire
Except that you would also have to take account of the fact that the coal plant can run all the time, whereas the windmills will only run between 20 to 40% of the time, depending on the wind conditions.
Right. Which is why you need all those electric cars.
That's right.
There you go. Dr. Henrik Binsleif is with us, and we'll take your calls here, 866-303-2270. Chase in Palm Springs, California, you're on the air.
Hi, gentlemen. How are you doing?
Very well.
I have to admit, the concept of everybody kind of tapping into it, a vein, a heartbeat of energy. That concept to me is just unbelievable. That would be great for America. My question, though, is, and all the other stuff you guys are talking about is great. I appreciate the show and everything. How do I explain to my right-wing Republican friends here in America that an electric car, for example, or something like that is cleaner than fossil fuels? Because I always get this, the opposite, that fossil fuels, it's unbelievable to me here, but that the battery is more pollutant to the environment than a fossil fuel.
Well, there is reality to that. Thank you, Chase. There is some reality to the problem of the toxicity of the batteries. Well, how do you address that?
Well, the batteries have to be recyclable. You're absolutely right that as long as you have batteries that contain in a sense, also precious materials, you'll want
like
to recycle
cadmium.
Them. Well, you really don't want cadmium. You want at the moment, the main thought is lithium batteries. And lithium as such is not a problem. But in any case, it's a valuable resource. Mm-hmm. So you should be recycling your batteries, and that should be thought into the whole process, that we really don't want a graveyard of batteries. You're right. The other point is if you produce the electricity out of coal, well, then, of course, there's going to be carbon dioxide emissions in producing the electricity. But funnily enough, because modern coal plants are actually more efficient than your standard internal combustion engine in a car, mm-hmm. it still pollutes the environment less with carbon dioxide. But the really interesting one is if you're running off sustainable energy technologies.
Right, right. And you mentioned that in addition to wind, now we're in third-generation solar.
No, we're not in third yet. So solar cells...
You're working on them.
We're working on them. So solar cells are projected to become a very major contributor to our energy equation on the horizon of 2050. They will probably be competitive out at the consumer within something like 10 years or so, but the major energy producer in 2050.
Right. That's remarkable. Dr. Henrik Binsleif is with us, the director of RISU, DTU, and the scientist and researcher in the area of alternative energies here in Denmark. Tom Hartmann broadcasting live from Copenhagen. We'll be back with more of your calls right after this break. Stick around.
Tom Hartmann.
This is the Tom Hartmann Program.
DTU, pardon my terrible English pronunciation of your Danish acronyms, but one of the leading researchers in the country, I would say probably in the world, on this and many other topics. Len in New York City, you're on the air.
Hi. I miss Denmark. I haven't been there in a long, long time.
Why don't you come over?
Huh?
Why don't you come over?
It's
bring some tourist dollars.
No, just come and enjoy it.
Yeah.
The question I had was, I was trying to do the math. Once you said that it would be about 20 to 40% operational because of the wind, and I'm thinking one good thing is that the wind is the same. Wind is wind, whether it's in Saudi Arabia or in upstate New York. But if it's, let's assume it's about 30% operational, and you were saying that it takes 100 about for a coal plant, then you would need about 300, let's say, of those to equal a coal plant operating full time.
Yes.
I was just wondering what the relative costs might be.
And
there was one other question before I forget. I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Let's assume you had a 200 acre, like whatever acreage area squared. How close can you put them? How many windmills can you set up within an area?
Very good questions. So you're right that we need about 300 per coal power plant. And the density with which they can sit, that is dependent on really how quickly does the energy in the wind field replenish itself from the upper air layers. So the wind higher up has to filter back down to earth and replenish. So you can only put it so close. And that is actually an area of research that we're doing at the moment. But the rule of thumb is that it's between a factor of 3 to 7 times the diameter of the rotor. So there's a finite density. The other thing that's affecting it is that one windmill will cause turbulence, which downstream from it will affect not so much the energy production of the next windmill, but it will affect its lifetime. How long? The more turbulence there is in the wind, the more wear you have on the turbine. So there's definitely an economic optimum for how closely you space them.
Fascinating.
Did you have another? I think I didn't catch your first question. Did I answer?
No, you answered. Oh, his question: the cost relative.
The
cost
relative
of 300
cost,
windmills
versus
coal-fired plant.
So that's actually well known because operators of wind farms, they bid in, and they in Denmark and most of the European countries. I'm sure it's probably the case in the U.S. as well. But the way it works in Denmark is that an operator will offer to run the farm at a fixed price for the electricity. So they will want a minimum price. And that currently that is higher than coal power plants. I think it's by maybe even a factor of 2. But that's not, of course, taking into account future prices on carbon dioxide.
Right.
And some very good studies have been carried out, amongst others by McKinsey and Vattenfall. Vattenfall is a big company, energy company in Sweden, where they have judged at what price of carbon dioxide, at what price of carbon dioxide would various technologies be competitive. And their land-based windmills is actually the ones that are at the lowest price of all the sustainable energy technologies, but it's not competitive with coal if you don't have to pay for those CO2.
If you don't consider the external costs of coal.
Yes.
But didn't Sweden just impose a $300 per ton tax on carbon?
Oh, I don't think it's that high. That would surprise me.
Yeah.
But I'm not knowledgeable of it.
Yeah.
But that would be very high.
Maybe it was $300 per 1,000 tons. Or something.
No, I don't know the number.
But they're seriously looking at that or doing that.
But that's what it's about worldwide, is to try and put a price on carbon. And that's actually something that businesses in the U.S. are also asking, because at the moment in the U.S. it's irritating much of your developers that they cannot exactly know what carbon dioxide price to figure in the future.
Right, right. And therefore, there needs to be some sort of standardization. Richard in San Luis Obispo, listening on KYNS. Hey, Richard.
Hi. I wonder if you guys have experimented with horizontal turbines as well as vertical ones.
Horizontal turbines.
Yeah.
That you've got to explain. So there's various there are various forms.
So like a jet engine, you mean?
No. When they were doing a lot of the foundational experimentation with wind power back in the 1970s with a lot of government funding, One of the more promising areas was horizontal turbines that used various types of vanes, but the whole thing propelled went around a horizontal axis. So instead,
you don't mean a vertical axis, do you? Because the current ones have a horizontal axis.
Okay, well,
you mean a vertical axis, I think.
So the ones that look like a like sort of like a Mobius strip of vertical.
Yes, and that we did. Yes, okay, indeed. Yeah. So those we were working on, and in fact we still are on paper still doing various studies, because there were good aspects of those, good elements in those designs, and so they may just come back again, but probably not in the short term on land. But they are interesting, those concepts, and they're not forgotten.
Now, you said earlier when we were talking off the air that there was a possibility that you could be building floating platforms?
Indeed, because in some countries, Denmark being one of them, it's just not possible to develop further any more wind power on land. We have to move into the sea. And there, at the moment, we're doing that by putting it on foundations out in shallow waters. But the potential is much greater if you could have floating windmills, and concepts for that are being developed just now. One of the challenges is that these huge structures vibrate, and now they also vibrate in the water, and that needs to be understood.
Yeah, and how do you do that, and how do you get them out?
Well, actually, the being floating, that's in a sense makes some of the logistics easier, because you could imagine assembling them near the shore, for instance, in the fjord, and then you pull them out of sea, just like you do with an oil rig.
That's great. Dr. Heinrich Binsler, thank you so much.
This is the Tom Hartmann Program.
You're in the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartmann. You're listening to Tom Hartmann.
The Tom Hartmann Program.
The True People's Radio.
This is Tom Hartmann.
And if you haven't figured it out by now, Tom Hartmann here with you, broadcasting live from Copenhagen, Denmark, all this week. Last week, I believe it was last week, Scott McClellan testified before the House Judiciary Committee, John Conyers Committee, and Robert Wexler, who a frequent guest on this program, had some interesting comments about this. This is what Mr. Wexler said, Congressman Wexler.
Thank you, Mr. McClellan, for exposing some of the lies that were propagated by this White House. But unfortunately, as you have said, I believe as well, others in this White House have been blocking access to the truth. It's time we sweep away the bogus claims of executive privilege and get Karl Rove, Andy Card, and others before this Judiciary Committee. We have the power of inherent contempt, and if need be, we should use it. Mr. McClellan, what you have provided today for the American people is enormously important. You are the first high official in this administration to come before this Congress and offer us a glimpse into the truth. I commend you for being here today.
Thank you, Congressman. I do believe it's important for the American people to have the truth.
And that's Scott McClellan responding to Robert Wexler. And Scott McClellan on the line with us right now. Scott, welcome.
Tom, thanks for having me on the show. Glad to be with you today.
Very pleased to have you with us. Your new book, What Happened? Inside the Bush White House and Washington's Culture of Deception. And, of course, I probably don't need to say it, but you were the former press secretary to George W. Bush. You served as press secretary from 2003 to 2006. Before that, the principal deputy White House press secretary and traveling press secretary for Bush Cheney 2000. To what extent do you feel that you were, on the one hand, duped, or on the other hand, part of what may be described, and tell me if you think I'm describing it too harshly, as a criminal enterprise, essentially?
I would disagree with the criminal enterprise. I can't speak to the motivations or intentions of every individual, but I don't think that there is a group sitting around the table saying, let's figure out how we can mislead the American people into war. I don't think Colin Powell and others would have stood for that. Now, whether or not certain individuals were trying to push their own agenda and engaging in stuff that needs to be brought to light, that's another matter. And I certainly think that there are a lot of answers, and there's a lot of suspicion that is there, because this this White House has not been open and candid with the American people, and I wish that that would change. Unfortunately, I don't think it will change.
Yeah, I think you're right. Do you feel that you need to, as a consequence of having been a cheerleader for this war, wittingly or unwittingly propagating information that was not accurate, shall we say it, to be delicate, that you need to ask for forgiveness from the American people or work out some sort of, is this part of a process for you of kind of cleaning up your own karma?
Well, it was certainly a long process going through and writing this book and coming to the conclusions that I did, but I'm comfortable with where I ended. It's the truth from my perspective. I think it's important to share my experiences openly so that we can learn from them, so that we don't repeat these mistakes again. One of the things I talk about is the permanent campaign culture. It's one of the larger themes in the book, and the need to improve the way Washington governs for the better. I certainly got caught up in it at times, like so many other good people that come to Washington do as well. And we've got to understand how this culture accepts this certain level of political spin and manipulation, and how troubling that becomes when it's transferred over into the war-making process, where the American people need to have the truth of the situation as best we know it and understand the consequences and cost and risks as clearly as possible. And we didn't give that to the American people. Now, in the build-up to the war, I was the deputy press secretary, so my role was more limited in some of the activities there. But like a lot of Americans, I was willing to give the administration and the foreign policy team the benefit of the doubt, thinking that, you know, they were highly regarded at the time. That trust I placed in them in hindsight was misplaced, and I think that, you know, a lot of Americans feel that way as well.
Yeah, certainly many of us do. This is such a tough one because, you know, in 1999, George Bush told Mickey Herskowitz, who was the guy that his mother and father hired to write his autobiography, A Charge to Keep. In 1999, he told Mickey Herskowitz, and Herskowitz is on the record about this, and it was published in I think it was The Atlantic about 5 years ago now, that George W. This was even before he had announced that he was running for president, that if he became president, he would not make the mistake that his father made and pull out of Iraq quickly before an election, but that he would invade Iraq, he would go to Baghdad, he would gain considerable political capital as a consequence of that, and he would use that political capital to accomplish the domestic agenda that he had, which included things like privatizing Social Security. So here we have the president, you know, or we have George W. Bush, before he was president, saying if he became president, he was basically going to have a war, which ultimately led to the death of thousands, perhaps hundreds of thousands of people, the second largest refugee crisis in the world, over 4.5 million displaced persons, not to mention 3 million displaced persons in Afghanistan, apparently purely for political purposes. That frankly to me seems somewhere between sociopathic and criminal.
Well, I can understand where you're coming from. I don't think it was purely for political purposes. It's hard to get in someone's head and know how much some of that played into his thinking, but you can't discount it at the same time. Certainly that he was predisposed to target Saddam Hussein from the beginning, and September 11th gave the president and some of his advisors who were encouraging him to go forward an opportunity to carry out some of their preconceived desires, I think, in a lot of ways. But the driving motivation for the president that I saw when I became press secretary and heard in private meetings with world leaders and others was really this ambitious, idealistic vision that Iraq could be the linchpin for transforming the rest of the Middle East into a peaceful and democratic region. Now, whether or not you agree with that or not, that was what was driving him. And it was what misguided him in many ways, this idea that he could achieve this legacy of greatness and that it would be relatively easy and at a low cost. And we see today how misguided that was, with the irrevocable cost in terms of 4,100 troops killed and, as you said, at least tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, innocent Iraqis killed in the process as well. I'm one who believes that we should not be going to war unless it's absolutely necessary. And it's clear to me today and many others that this war was not necessary. There are other ways we could have confronted Saddam Hussein.
Right. You were the deputy communications director for George Bush when he was the Texas governor.
That's right.
And which is the time he was talking to Mickey Herskowitz. Did you ever hear him express to you or in your presence before becoming president or before 9/11 a desire to attack Iraq?
I did not. Now, when I originally went to work for him too, I had all this idealism and hope and trust in him because he was this popular bipartisan governor. He had 70% plus approval ratings. But it's clear to me today that when he got to Washington, he was more inclined to play the game the way it's played under the existing rules rather than transform it. But I did not hear that at that time.
Many of the White House press corps are reporters. I mean, you know, probably most of them are journalism school graduates. They're, you know, arguably reporters, but many of them are also basically TV stars, and they have anywhere from $200,000 a year to $1 million a year paychecks to protect, and their companies are multi-billion-dollar companies in the case of the big three networks, and they have access to protect. To what extent, you know, the story of Helen Thomas being relegated to the back of the room after she asked, you know, one tough question of George W. Bush after sitting at the front of the room all the way back to the Eisenhower
right.
years. To what extent were you or others in the White House involved in the process of basically intimidating the press?
Well, it's not the way I operated. There was a little bit of that that I saw went on from the communication standpoint, but I tended to go to the reporters directly and deal with them if we had a problem. And I think it was wrong to do what happened to Helen Thomas, and we later reversed that, and the president started calling her on her and so forth. But that is a problem in any administration, and certainly there were times when we engaged in it.
It's still going on, is it not?
I would think to some extent. Not being on the inside anymore or welcome on the inside anymore, I think it's still going on to some extent.
Yeah, I'm curious what your future is. It seems to me like you're like one of these mafia informants who needs to go into a witness protection program.
Well, I am in uncharted waters. We'll see. I would like to look at some possibilities to continue focusing on changing the way Washington governs for the better, whether it's in the academic world or think tank world or other ways. It's really what drives me, and I really want to try to continue making a positive difference. And I've been pleased by the way people have responded so positively to the larger message in the book now that they've gotten beyond the initial orchestrated attacks on my credibility and me personally, which are turned out to be very inaccurate. No one was refuting the larger themes and perspectives.
Yeah, and there's an enormous amount of fascinating insights in this, and I thank you for writing this book, and I know it's very fashionable to pick on you basically for having put up with it as long as you did, but you're doing the right thing, and
I appreciate it, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you, Scott McClellan. His book, What Happened Inside the Bush White House and Washington's Culture of Deception. Thanks again, Scott. 16 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program.
Transforming the world by revitalizing democracy.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
In Denmark, past the hour of 8 p.m. that would be, 21 minutes after 2 on the East Coast and after 11 on the West Coast. But anyhow, it's today is my jet lag day. Welcome back. And tomorrow, by the way, on the program, we're going to have the editor of the newspaper that published the infamous Danish cartoons of Muhammad. And that's going to be an interesting conversation. I'm very much looking forward to that. And what's his name? And also, I don't have it right here in front of me. In any case, and also we're going to have on the guy who authored the study that found that Denmark is, or that the Danes are the happiest people in Europe, happiest people in the world, among the happiest people in the world. So, Russ Feingold. Let me just shift topics here. And by the way, our phone number, 866-303-2270, if you want to call in here in this last hour. Russ Feingold coming right out and saying it. We spent a lot of time last week, Thursday and Friday, talking about this absurd rewrite of the FISA legislation that Nancy Pelosi basically said, I'm not a lawyer, and stepped back and got out of the way. And Steny Hoyer, who may or may not be a lawyer. I don't know. Steny Hoyer of Maryland took this thing, the House Majority Leader, and ran it through the House. And now it's going to the Senate, where Senator Russ Feingold has said, anybody who claims that this is an okay bill, I really question if they've even read it. Have they even read it? It's like the Patriot Act. Remember the Patriot Act? I'm just waiting for the, God forbid, for the anthrax to show up or something like that. Here they had this god-awful piece of legislation, 1,100 pages, as I recall, this brick of legislation that the Republicans have been working on for years. For years they had been putting this thing together. I mean, back in the Reagan administration, pieces of the Patriot Act they had tried to get passed. And every single time they trotted it out, even the Republicans would look at it and go, what are you talking about with this fascistic now? You want to tear apart the Constitution? You know, people like Bob Barr even would get incensed when they tried to roll this stuff out. And then 9/11 happens. And so they trot out the Patriot Act, but the two top Democrats, now Jim Jeffords, the Republican from Vermont, was so horrified, this is in the first months of the new legislative session, was so horrified by what he saw his own party doing with regard to No Child Left Behind, of all things. I mean, that was the issue that flipped him over the edge, because education was Jim Jeffords' thing. And in fact, his office and he provided me with some information that made its way into one of my books. I think it was either What Would Jefferson Do or Unequal Protection, that showed that the No Child Left Behind Act basically would turn multi-million and multi-hundred-million-dollar testing companies into multi-billion-dollar testing companies. It was basically a let's force schools to give more money to private corporations so that they can buy 5 cents worth of paper for $25. That was what No Child Left Behind was all about. And Jim Jeffords knew it. And so he said, that's it. I'm out of the party. He flipped the Senate from Republican to Democratic. And so now Pat Leahy, his colleague from Vermont, became the chairman of the Judiciary Committee. And Tom Daschle became the majority leader in the Senate. The guy who got to decide what legislation comes up for a vote. So there's two guys in the Senate who could stop the Patriot Act. It had to get out of the Judiciary Committee. It had to get out of Pat Leahy's committee. And he had said, I got some real problems with this thing. And then once it got out of his committee, it had to go before Tom Daschle, who had to say, yes or no, we're going to put it on the schedule for a vote. He was playing the role that Harry Reid is playing right now. And both of these guys were not inclined to pass the Patriot Act. And two people. Two politicians in Washington, D.C., in the midst of this discussion, get anthrax in the mail, have to evacuate their offices, have to leave behind all their research, leave behind all their paperwork, leave behind all the, a terrified staff and everything else. And guess who? The only two politicians were who got the anthrax. Pat Leahy and Tom Daschle. So, I'm just... what's going to happen with this thing in the Senate? This is amazing. So, Russ Feingold, I tip my hat to you, sir. He says, this is a farce and it's political cover. He says, Democrats enabled this. Some of the rank and file Democrats in the Senate who were elected on this reform platform unfortunately voted with Kit Bond, who's just giggling. He's so happy with what he got. We caved in. Over in the House, of course. Now, what's going to happen in the Senate? Apparently this bill, this FISA bill, is going to come before the Senate tomorrow. So today might be a good day to call your senators. Go to callcongress.org. There's a whole bunch of toll-free numbers there. There's also the same list, basically, of toll-free numbers are published over at the Daily Kos. There's a good post on this. Toll-free numbers. And just call in. If you're not even sure who your two senators are, every state has two except the District of Columbia. If you're not sure who they are, just tell them what state you live in and they'll tell you. And just say, hey, connect me to Senator so-and-so's office. And, of course, you may want to let Harry Reid know what you're thinking about this. He represents all of us as well. We'll be taking your calls next, 866-303-2270. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
I've been waiting for something to happen, for a week or a month or a year, with the blood in the ink of the headline and the sound of the crowd in my ear. You might ask what it takes to remember when you know that you've seen it before, where a government lies to a people and a country is drifting to war. There's a shadow on the faces of the men who send the gun to the wars that are fought in places where their business interests run. On the radio, talk shows, and the TV, you hear one thing again and again: how the USA stands for freedom, and we come to the aid of a friend. But who are the ones that we call our friends? These governments are killing their own.
35 minutes past the hour. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. Oh, I can listen to Jackson Browne for an hour. I can listen to Jackson Browne for a week. Non-stop! 35 minutes past the hour. I guess I already said that. 866-303-2270. And, oh my. Greg in Missoula, Montana, listening on KLCY. Hey, Greg, what's up?
Hey, Tom. First of all, thanks for your show. It's just great to hear a voice of reason out there. I just wanted to comment. I was watching Meet the Press this past Sunday, and we had Senator Lindsey Graham from South Carolina and Joe Biden from Delaware. And for 20 minutes, all they did was argue with each other. They could not agree on seemingly one simple point. Brian Williams tried to ask straight questions, could not get a straight answer from either of them. And it just, to me, typifies what's wrong with our national politics in Washington. We just are so off the mark on so many things. It's just amazing to me. And I don't really have a point other than saying that. It just,
yeah.
I've written to our senators here, and you get these lame email responses, and it's like, yeah. Is anybody listening?
It's all about gotcha politics. Greg, thank you for the call, and I think your point is well made and well taken. There, first of all, I mean, you know, like Biden voted for he's a good guy, but he voted for the bankruptcy bill. Why? Well, you got all these credit card companies in Delaware, surprise! So, I mean, and Lindsey Graham, he wants to amend the Constitution to do away with the Constitution, apparently. Let's strip out the Fourth Amendment. Yeah, him and Scalia. On this terrorist, so-called, you know, detainees, these people whose brother-in-law didn't like them, and they decided to get the bounty. So there's gotcha politics, there's moneyed politics, and really it brings us back to the larger question. And I've been thinking about this all week as I've been here, what, 3 days now, but all the time I've been here in Denmark, and this is the question that I think as Americans we need to be asking ourselves economically, but also politically, and Dale, you framed it perfectly. Is the economy here to serve the people, or are the people here to serve the economy? See, I think what you find in Denmark is that the purpose of the economy, every business that exists at a certain level to serve the people. And to make money. In the United States, it's the other way around. The idea that has become ascendant since the presidency of Ronald Reagan is that the economy is here to serve the people who own the economy. And you and I, the worker bees, the people who are just, you know, the cogs in the wheel, we're there to serve the economy. And it's the same thing with government. Is government here to serve us, or are we here to serve government? And increasingly, as we are seen simply as votes or as folks who can be manipulated, tragically, it's we are not having a government that serves us. And you know, we've got to do something about that. And frankly, I think the thing to do about that is to get active. Dale in New York City. Hey, Dale, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, hi, Tom. I'm upstate New York. How are you doing today?
Great.
Good. Yeah, I just wanted to, I just had a question. When you had Scott McClellan on just for a moment, he made a mention to the fact that with the president ordering, you know, the involvement in Iraq, I just found it's pretty interesting whereby all the reasons for why we're over there just kept changing. I mean, it started with, you know, we're going after Osama bin Laden, yet he's still not captured. And, you know, with all the other discoveries after that, it just kept changing all the reasons as to why we're over there. And, you know, up to the point where they say Saddam Hussein was a bad man, and so that's why we were after him. So
you found that same thing,
you know?
Yeah, I did. What I thought was interesting and perhaps revealing, and I haven't read Scott's book all the way through. I have read probably 80 pages of it, just, you know, randomly flipping through and reading here and there. It was the most I could do before I left on this trip. But what I got from reading the parts that I did read was what Scott said on the radio today, which I think we should take more seriously, which is that the rationale that Bush was putting forward, even in the early days, was this rationale of creating a democracy in Iraq will become the anchor for democracies across the region. And you would think any idiot could simply look at what happened in Egypt, for example, when Mubarak finally decided, okay, we'll have a really democratic election, and then it looked like the Muslim fundamentalists were going to win, and he pulled the plug on the election at the last minute and said, oops, we're not going to do that.
Yeah.
Or what happened in Pakistan, or what, I mean, you know, go on through the list. I mean, or any other country where we've tried to impose democracy, at the, you know, with a barrel of a gun. It just doesn't work. But this is the thing that was being promoted by the neoconservatives. This is what the Project for New American Century was all about, or at least it was their main public rationale. And you had a number of Huntington and others. You had a number of these neoconservative thinkers out there and writers. And Dale, thank you for the call and raising the topic out there, bringing this stuff up and saying, well, you know, really this is all about altruism. Really, this is about establishing democracy because, you know, no two democratic nations have ever gone to war against each other in history. And that, by and large, is true, as a matter of fact. And so, therefore, if we can simply turn the whole world democratic, we'll have peace in the world. Well, you know, Adolf Hitler was promoting 1,000 years of peace with the Third Reich. There's no shortage of people with wacky ideas to bring peace to the world. But that, you know, blowing up Iraq and creating 4.5 million refugees and killing a couple hundred thousand people, not the way to do it. Cheryl Christ, Olympia, Washington. Hey, Cheryl.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for doing all the good work you do educating people. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
As you may know, I'm the candidate for that area across the river from you, Vancouver, Washington.
Mm-hmm.
Can you hear me?
I can. Now, you're talking about Brian Baird's district.
That's right.
I thought that you ran against him in the primary. But wasn't the primary like a month ago?
No, we haven't had it yet. August 19th.
Oh, okay. So the Democratic primary for the congressional seats was not the same time as the presidential primary in Washington State?
Correct.
Oh.
All of these levels, at the state level for governor and House representatives, Senate, and so forth, on down to the local levels, all of that occurs August 19th by mail-in ballot.
Right. Okay. So very interesting. Cheryl, you got a website?
And, the website is CRISP for Congress, four is spelled out, crispforcongress.us.
.us, C-R-I-S-T.
And since Congressman Baird's vote on Friday for the FISA, the telecom communication, I've gotten a lot of calls.
Yeah,
that people have told me for them that was the tipping point for them.
Yep.
And that they're willing to vote for a challenger.
Okay, Cheryl, good luck. I wish you the best, and thanks for the call. That's a tough one because, Brian Baird's a good guy, but that vote, among a few others, was not a good vote. Denny in Wenatchee, Washington. Hey, Denny.
Hi, Tom. I was calling to talk about that vote that they're going to take on the immunity for the telecoms.
Right.
And last week I called both of our senators, Murray and Cantwell, and Senator Obama, and I'm a big Obama supporter. I've been contributing once a month what I can. But I, and this is not a threat, no, it's not meant that way, it's strictly a matter of conscience. I emailed them and told them that, you know, I believe in him and I believe in change and I believe he's going to stand up and fight this. But if he doesn't, I'm going to reconsider. I won't contribute anymore. And I'm going to have to think about something else come the general election, because this to me is just mind-boggling. I mean, I'm 62, and I never thought I would see this happen in this country, where the United States Congress would sit there and ask for immunity for violating our Fourth Amendment rights for anyone.
Denny, I
believe he will do it. I think he will. I believe his change is legitimate. And I'm looking forward to that this week, and I would hope everyone
I am too.
And
MoveOn.org, MoveOn.org is promoting that well. And, Denny, thanks for the call and for making the point. We just have a little less than a minute left. Glenn in Wisconsin. Hey, Glenn, you've been calling Feingold's office?
Yeah, well, actually, I've been calling. First, I called Obama's office, and his voice, his mailbox is full.
Right.
Then I called Senator Clinton's office, and her lines are busy. Then I called my other senator, Senator Cole, and his lines are busy. I called Senator Feingold. I got through. And the staff member didn't exactly know what he was going to do, but she certainly was happy to pass on my admonition that he support the filibuster.
Yeah.
So I don't know. Support is one thing. I'm just wondering who's going to do it.
Yeah, so am I. The next 48 hours are going to tell us a lot about the people who are sitting in the United States Senate right now.
Now, when are they actually going to have this vote, do you know?
My understanding is that Wednesday, tomorrow, there's going to be basically a procedural vote, and Thursday will be the real fireworks. But, you know, it's all up to Harry Reid, and it could all change in a heartbeat. So I don't know the details. But one of the best blogs, you know, that has a lot of good information on this right now is Daily Kos. I recommend you check it out, dailykos.com. 45 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman.
Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman.com, AirAmerica.com, HartmanRadio.com, actually. I think it gets you directly to my page on the Air America site. Flo in Sunrise, Florida. Hey, Flo, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. You know, I missed a little bit of your show, and I'd like to know if you discussed the oil law that was passed in Iraq for the Western oil companies to secure the oil there.
Other than mentioning it in passing, what, 2 days ago, I think, or yesterday. I haven't done a major rant on it, but it is, you know, what the biggest problem with this, in my opinion, now that the oil companies are back after 50 years, you know, after the Iraqis threw them out and now they're back, is that it is causing everybody else in the world to say, see, we told you so. Now we know why these guys went in there. And
all
those
lies that were told about the war. And long before I knew that why Bush was going in there, because Gore Vidal was on C-SPAN saying it's all about oil.
Yeah.
This was years ago.
Yeah.
Right after 9/11.
See, I think that I'm not of the opinion it was all about oil. I think that it was primarily about political power. It was about getting a Republican majority back in the Senate in 2002 in that election. It was about electing more Republicans to the House in 2004 and getting Bush reelected. And this is what Bush said in 1999, is he was going to do it to gain political power. And then I think that you had the Cheney folks who wanted to do it because they wanted the oil, Dick and all his buddies.
Well,
I don't think George was
something?
That
it's the way they went about it that I don't like, the force that they're using. Even in the elections, they just seem corrupt to me. Everything they do is arm-twisting. And I called when Bernie Sanders was on your show, and the Iraqi people were coming out of their mosques. They didn't want us involved in long-term presence over in Iraq. So how do they get this passed?
Yeah. Good question, Flo, and I don't know the answer right off the top of my head. I'm sorry. It's one of those things that has happened in the last couple of days that I have not had the opportunity, because we've been up to our eyeballs trying to figure out how Denmark works to get all the details on. So, Connie in Orange County, California, listening on KGN.
Well, I think it's really important that we tell, excuse me, our senators that they're the ones getting spied on.
Yeah.
I've always felt that Daschle, the anthrax, was to go run around Daschle's office, and now it's really important.
Or just to keep him out of it, you know, just to scare the hell out of him and keep him out of his office, you know, which happened.
And then he lost shortly after that. But think about Nixon and who he spied on. This leaves Watergate in the dust. The people that have the most are at the highest risk are all the Democratic senators, and their mail, their phones. We need to remind them that you guys are the targets. You need to stand up, find your integrity, and vote against this.
Yeah. Amen, Connie. Well said. And absolutely. And beyond that, let's keep in mind that the Republicans actually did spy on the Democrats. There was a guy out of Orrin Hatch's office, one of his aides, who actually hacked into Teddy Kennedy's computer. And for a year, they were reading the computer correspondence of Democrats in the Senate, particularly when as it had to do with the confirmation of all these right-wing judges that the Republicans were throwing up, and Bush kept tossing, you know, sending down to the Senate to be confirmed. And the Democrats could not figure out how it was that the Republicans knew their strategy in advance. And it was because there is, and Orrin Hatch has fessed up to it. He fired the guy, and it's like nobody remembers. It was a one-day story in the media. The Republicans, for over a year, every single day, were spying on the Democrats. You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. And what's to cause, you know, oh, they're spying on us with telephones? Well, guess who else they're spying on? Rex in Castro Valley. Hey, Rex.
Hello, Mr. Hartman.
Yes, sir.
Yes, I would like to ask you what you would think of Mr. Senator Obama choosing George Meany, the AFL-CIO, as his running mate for the vice president.
I don't think George Meany is George Meany's a great guy, but I don't think that he's interested in being vice president, and I don't think Obama picking him would be a particularly good idea. But somebody who is strong on labor, yeah. I mean, there is a tide changing in the United States right now, and the whole issue of labor is coming back. I mean, it's the American labor movement is coming back, I believe. Rich in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Rich.
Hi. I was calling before I talked to the senator to find out what's the evidence for the wiretapping before 9/11.
The violations of the FISA Act, as I recall, did not begin, although the media reports that they all began immediately after 9/11. My understanding is that this stuff happened weeks or months before 9/11, perhaps as soon as Bush came into office. He was violating the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. Janine, I'll have to get the details to you on that when I'm back in the United States. Janine in Phoenix, Arizona, listening on KPHX. We've got a half a minute here, Janine.
That's okay. Quickly, Tom, I just called Harry Reid's office, and the response was not encouraging. They cannot say which way the senator intends to vote. All they can say is that he does not agree with giving immunity, but there are parts of the bill that he does like. And
for example?
They won't say. They won't say.
Oh, man.
When I said, okay, I need to call the rest of the people on the committee, they said, well, that is your right.
Yeah, well, in fact, it is, and I encourage you to exercise it.
Exactly. But, you know, Harry's noncommittal at this point,
which I find
very disturbing.
Yeah, it's truly tragic. Janine, thanks for the...
Thank you, Tom. Bye-bye.
Yeah, thanks for doing the right thing, for calling Harry Reid and presumably calling your senators there. Even though one of them is John McCain. Coming up Wednesday on the Tom Hartman program, Tyler Brule, editor-in-chief of Monocle Magazine. What makes Copenhagen the most livable city in the world? What American cities made the list? We'll also find out from the author of the happiness study, Kari Christensen, why Denmark is the happiest place in the world. Plus, Terry Jeffrey, editor-in-chief of CNS News. He and I will mix it up on the issues of the day. Don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. Get out there, get active. Call your senators now. See you tomorrow.
You are listening to Tom Hartman.
For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit HartmanRadio.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.